We are going to be uncharacteristic, and we're going to start this thing only 5 minutes late instead of 10. Well, first of all, I want to welcome all of you to USIP. Thank you very much for spending your morning. This is actually a good showing for a South Asia event. Usually if we get 20, that's a good day. So this tells me that the speaker's good and the topic's good. The reason why we have held this event, aside from the fact that Samina Ahmed's in town, and it's always good to have Samina Ahmed speak, is that the tribal areas of Pakistan, FATA, the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan, have for the last year and a half, maybe even longer, depending on who you are and where you sit, have focused the attention of policymakers because of the changing nature of the insurgency in Afghanistan, ongoing reports that there are Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and allied fighters, not necessarily receiving sanctioned sanctuary, but nonetheless do have access to these territories. And there are obvious operational implications not only for Afghanistan, but there are also enormous internal security implications for Pakistan, as the various assassination attempts on Musharraf demonstrate. So we're very lucky. Samina Ahmed is here. I don't believe she needs an introduction. You have her bio. But she oversees the International Crisis Group's operations in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Nepal. And there's one more.
Sri Lanka.
Basically, if it's in South Asia, she runs it. And I'm sure some of you or all of you have seen her recent report on the federally administrated tribal areas of Pakistan, and she's going to be giving us an overview of some of the key insights of that report. But also, since she is Samina Ahmed, she's also going to be broadening the discussion to a variety of issues pertaining to Pakistani internal security. I'm also very fortunate that my colleague, Kamar Ahuda, is going to be serving as insightful moderator and traffic cop. And with that, Samina Ahmed. Oh, also, cell phones must be off.
Off.
It has a terrible reverb with the sound, as you hear this crackling, and so that's why I have to be adamant that they're off.
You know, part of the problem is never carry cell phones. You never find them when you're trying to, till they ring. So if it does ring, don't kill me. I'll shut it off right away.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here and to talk about an issue that I think a few years ago nobody would have actually shown any interest in, which is the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan. I don't think anybody knew that there was such a thing as FATA, except for the few people who actually worked on the region and extensively covered particularly that Northwest Frontiers tribal belt. Chris is absolutely right. There's a huge amount of attention being focused right now on the tribal belt, in particular the tribal belt of the Northwest Frontier Province, less so the bordering areas of Balochistan at the moment, largely because of the events in Afghanistan. 2005, 2006, but particularly 2006, there's a huge amount of concern about not just the internal problems that Afghanistan faces, but also the cross-border nature of the insurgency. You probably, all of you, read any number of reports and testimonies given by senior U.S. officials, military and intelligence in particular, about Taliban bases, Taliban recruitment, Taliban command and control. And the latest is Mr. Negroponte's statement and the follow-up statements after that in testimonies about Al-Qaeda finding itself a base in some of these areas. The other issue, of course, is it pertains directly to, as Chris said, Pakistan's own security, which is the militant presence. And I should say this, in our own report on FATA, we had to make a distinction just for clarity more than anything else, that the militants in FATA call themselves the Taliban. These are Pakistanis. So we call them the pro-Taliban militants to distinguish themselves, this group or this lot, from the Afghan Taliban. But other than that, they see no distinction between themselves and the Afghan Taliban. I would also add here that it's not just pro-Taliban elements in these regions, but also Hikmatyar Hizb-e-Islami and its supporters. So it's not just the one insurgent group within Afghanistan that has a presence in FATA, but also yet another problematic insurgent group which is challenging the control of the Kabul government, which is Hikmat-e-Ars Hizb-e Islami. The Talibanization of this region is, if you've actually seen some of the debate on this that's come out, is yet another issue of concern. One of the things that the U.S. government has talked about is that it doesn't want to see Pakistan also becoming Talibanized, in other words, Talibanization spreading in this particular region, and with good cause, because what we have seen in the past year or so, more visibly so, is the presence of a particular type of militancy, but also actions that resemble very closely what we saw and knew of the Taliban in Afghanistan. Since these people, as much as their supporters across the border, believe that the Taliban form of government is the best form of government, and that is what they aspire to create within Pakistan's tribal belt. But why is it that we see this happening? I mean, I'd say that they are immediate causes and they're root causes, and we need to understand them both, because you cannot understand where the problem lies, and you cannot find a solution unless you know what the problem is. The immediate cause, frankly speaking, is the kinds of military operations that were carried out very recently, 2003-2004 onwards, in these regions. Huge amount of pressure was put on the Pakistanis by the United States, more concerned about Al-Qaeda than the Taliban, I would think so, to actually take action to eliminate extremist elements that had actually taken sanctuary across Pakistan's tribal belt after the coalition operation started. The Pakistani military went in there and conducted very poor... The military operations were not just poorly conducted. They actually, you know, if the intention was to eliminate or to curtail extremism, it actually fueled extremism, because there was the use of excessive force. In some ways, it resembled very much the situation in Afghanistan, if you remember, right after coalition operation started, and excessive force did lead to a certain degree of support for the Taliban in areas where people had distanced themselves from the Taliban. Here, too, the same phenomena happened. But what also happened was, because there was a groundswell of support because of excessive force being used for the militants fought back. And as a result, military casualties are very high. And as the military took casualties, it decided to look for an exit strategy. And so the pendulum swung from excessive force to unconditional appeasement. And a series of peace deals were reached with the militants, from South Waziristan first, and then followed by the agreement that I think has been highlighted the most here, which is the September agreement in North Waziristan. And why I say it's unconditional appeasement, I mean, yes, of course, these are Pakistani citizens, and the Pakistani military would be averse to either seeing its own troops being killed or fighting its own people, but not the way these agreements were reached, which was the North Waziristan September agreement is actually a very interesting one, in which they actually released all the militants that had been arrested. They turned over all the arms that had been captured. They turned over the communications equipment to the militants. They removed military checkposts, and they, in effect, ceded territory to the militants. Now, there were two red lines drawn in that agreement. One of the red lines was that there would be no support for cross-border attacks, and that cross-border attacks would not take place from that particular border. The second red line drawn was that there should be no Talibanization. In other words, Taliban-style parallel administrative structures should not be set up. Well, guess what? Because these agreements were unconditional, and because territory had been ceded, the militants crossed both red lines. By all accounts, NATO, ISAF, UNAMA, you name it, the cross-border attacks increased dramatically after the agreements were signed. But also, Talibanization increased dramatically. And it's now, as we see this phenomenon spreading, it's going beyond just that very narrow tribal belt, beyond the Waziristans. You see, the Taliban and these are Pakistani Talibs, Pakistani militants, making their presence felt in the settled areas of the Northwest Frontier Province. There've been in recent weeks and months attacks on NGOs, on the media, any number of, the number is an approximate number, but perhaps close to 150 tribal elders were considered unsympathetic to the military, to the militant cause, have been killed. You see these horrific pictures and CDs. This is Taliban propaganda being distributed of the kinds of killings that I think even the Taliban in Afghanistan didn't conduct. But these are propaganda posters, and they actually say, if you are against us, this is your fate. But if you are with us, and they're Quranic verses, then you will go to heaven. Or, you are a true Muslim, you're a jihadi, you're a mujahid. But these are being distributed. So along with the sophisticated propaganda is a systematic onslaught on whatever remained of civil society in these areas. A huge number of people have actually left the region in fear of their lives. But even as they leave, they're being attacked. I mean, people, the tribal elders or journalists who've left and gone to places like Dera Ismail Khan or Banu Attank, and they've been attacked there. We see the implications of this policy of unconditional appeasement very clearly. I mean, the latest thing is what's just happened in Islamabad. You cannot make concessions to militants without a very difficult situation that you're going to face as militancy spreads. Instead of containing it and then eliminating it, it seems the government doesn't realize the implications of this policy for its own national security. Let me say this, that while this might be what we are seeing right now, the roots of the crisis in Fatah lie far beyond military operations or unconditional peace deals. This is a territory which, strangely enough, has been treated since Pakistan came into existence. These seven agencies and the tribal areas that are adjoin some of the major cities of the Northwest Frontier Province, like Peshawar and Kuhat, treated separate from the state. A colonial policy that has been pursued for 60-some years to treat Pakistani citizens living in this area as though they are not Pakistani citizens, but they are colonial subjects. The manner in which this region is administered, I think, speaks volumes for the rights of the people who live there. It's really a natural geographic part of the Northwest Frontier Province. They're Pashtuns, as Pashtuns everywhere else in the Northwest Frontier Province. They're not separate people. And yet, they are not a part of the Northwest Frontier Province. They have no representation in the provincial legislature, in the state legislature. They are controlled by the federal government out of Islamabad. The person who controls the Fatah region on behalf of the president is the governor of the Northwest Frontier Province, who is a representative, by the way, of the federation. So in other words, he works for the president, for Islamabad and not for the Northwest Frontier government. The person on the ground in every Fatah agency is the political agent. Can you imagine the term political agent being used right now? I mean, these are inherited terms from British days. The political agent has excessive powers, unbelievable. There's no checks and balances on the political agents' authorities, judicial powers, executive powers, fiscal powers, and exercises them on behalf of Islamabad, not on behalf of the people. There has been a dull franchise introduced, and very late in the day, believe it or not, in 1996 is when a dull franchise was introduced. But you know what? Not accompanied by political freedoms. So in other words, political parties are still not allowed to operate in a part of Pakistani territory. Beyond that, and this is even, more serious, there are no protections, judicial protections for the people. These are Pakistani citizens. They do not have the protection of the Pakistani courts because the writ of the courts does not extend to Fatah. Instead, there is a legal system, a legal administrative system, a structure codified in a set of laws called the Frontier Crimes Regulation 1901. this is the law that actually governs, that Fatah, the state governs Fatah through. A law which is unbelievable, again, in this day and age, to think that, you know, there is no access to justice, no recourse to the courts, no civil and political rights, but the state can take action legally against the people who live there through FCR. FCR has these interesting clauses such as collective responsibility and collective punishment. One of the reasons why the militants have gained so much support was just the use of the FCR by Islamabad. So if you know you wanted a foreign militant, you know, apprehended, you took action against the whole tribe. Or if one militant or a group of militants in a district attacked a security outpost, that whole area would be blockaded and the whole tribe would be held responsible. This is a concept of collective responsibility and also the concept of collective punishment. There were cases that the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan took up about children being, you know, infants in prison as Al-Qaeda supporters because the tribe had been held responsible for their actions. How do people within Fatah perceive this? Are these people different? You know, this wonderful myth that, oh, you know, this area has never been governed by any state, and then after all, these people are fiercely independent. We heard this about Afghanistan as well. And they will never let outsiders interfere in their local customs, and the jirga system works, and the tribal elders are the intermediaries between the people and the state, and tribalism is flourishing. In actual fact, you know, you go to Islamabad or you go to the Middle East, it's people from Fatah. They're working, I mean, part of the problem is it's so poor. It is so underdeveloped and poor. The literacy rate for women in Fatah is 3%. Okay? Health facilities, non-existent. Yes, you have roads. Yes, you have, you know, the visible presence of the state in these kinds of structures, but what do the people have? Very little. So these uneducated, very bright Pashtuns, you'll find them everywhere. In Dubai, in Karachi, are these people are they totally separate from the rest of Pakistan? No, they're not. They're a part of Pakistan. They see everybody else has civil and political rights. Everybody else, to a degree, everybody else at least constitutionally has protections, and they have none. So they are unions. The Fatah Union of Journalists, for example, the Fatah Union of Lawyers. We spoke to them. You know, these are people who are saying, give us the same status as equal citizens of the state, because otherwise the moderate majority, and it's the moderate majority in Fatah as well, you know, doesn't stand a chance. It will. The militants are the ones that benefit. Also because while political parties are not allowed to operate in Fatah, the only political parties that are allowed, well, actually absolute freedom of operation are the Islamist parties. And that's by General Musharraf. These peace deals, for example, that were made, first of all, let me just say this, because the Islamist parties have that kind of freedom of operation, they're the ones that gain the support when there are elections, right? By the way, Fatah has representatives in the National Assembly, not in the provincial legislature. So out of the 12, 10 are from the MMA, this Islamist Alliance, right? Of the 10, the vast majority are from the JUI, the party that aspires to follow some Mullah Omar's philosophy, and in some ways it's the party that thinks the Taliban are the best, again, just like the Taliban in Afghan and Pakistani Taliban in Fatah, that the Taliban did the right things and they were the right form of government for the region. These parties are allowed freedom and they have made inroads because the moderate parties are not allowed to operate in Fatah. Beyond that, there's an issue here which is, how much access do we have to Fatah? Okay? Because even to report on Fatah, the media has very, very limited access. First of all, because the militants attack journalists there, so local journalists have been threatened and a large number of them have left. These are people who are doing great coverage out of Fatah, and we were really understanding what was happening within. Foreign correspondents would probably not be allowed permission for security grounds. Now there is even more of a media clampdown. Now this is on the part of the state. There's a conflict raging right now in South Waziristan. Do we know what's happening there? Nobody knows. Oh, because the only version we get is from the government. So with no access to information, it becomes, the government's version becomes the version that we hear. But do we even know what the locals want? Actually, the locals, the ones that we've talked to in any case, and we had to talk to a large number of themselves, of these people outside Fatah, because they were too scared to talk within Fatah. So we talked to them in Tunk and Banu and Dera Ismail Khan, said we want to be equal citizens in a state with equal rights. We want the same protections, the same political and civil rights. We want to be, we don't want to be subjects of a state. We want to be equal citizens in the state. The U.S. government is now deeply concerned about what's happening in Fatah, largely because of, A, the Talibanization that is spreading, which is rightly perceived as a threat, and but much more so the cross-border attacks that are taking place, the recruitment that's taking place from Fatah. You know, I mean, there's one instance alone in which there were 60 or 70 young boys who marched across the border. I mean, these are young kids, indoctrinated and sent across, and they've, you know, just slaughtered. But their bodies come back. And then in the villages you have funerals. And there's a huge amount of anger, and that's a wonderful recruitment tool. So it's not just a matter of fear that the militants are supported, but it, you know, it's pretty sophisticated propaganda. So anyways, the U.S. government thinks that one way to go about it would be to set up these economic reconstruction zones, so that if there's development in Fatah, then, you know, that'd be one way of countering the militancy by providing people alternates to what they have at the moment, which is all very well and fine, but you know, okay, you pledge the money, you give it to the government. Who does it go to? Who are your local partners? Given the situation in Fatah right now, your local partners are going to be the Taliban, the Pakistani Talibs, that are running the show. Where are the tribal elders in the first place? The elder system of elders is a bit of a joke, because they're not elders in the first place. Maliks, you know, we like to call them tribal elders. When you talk to Pashtuns, they say the term Malik, and these are Pashtuns from the North Sarantay province, they say these Maliks are handpicked by the state. They don't represent us. The Jirgas are nominated, you know, so the government decides who's in a Jirga, who isn't in a Jirga. So when we talk about the Jirga system is again just a manipulated device. But more so, the fact that they don't have representation in the provincial legislature. So how can they, you know, find a different path for themselves? So while we talk about putting in monies into Fatah, it's all very well. If there are no civil and political rights granted to the people, if they cannot participate in the political process, if Fatah is still treated as a territory separate from the rest of Pakistan, there is no way that you can deal with the problems that Fatah is posing, not just to Afghanistan, but also to the Pakistani state, through this growth of militancy. Until and unless, and we have recommended in our report, we recommended it very strongly, and I was so pleased about it. Because when the report came out, our feedback was from the North Sarantay province. And we had any number of people say to us, we totally agree with you. Because we said, remove this artificial distinction. Merge Fatah into the North Sarantay province. Give the people of Fatah representation in the state legislature, in the North Sarantay legislature. Allow political parties to operate. Remove the curbs on political parties in Fatah. Extend, because if Fatah is incorporated into the North Sarantay province, the writ of the courts is extended automatically. Then you can have law enforcement. You do not need military operations that will create more problems for the Pakistani state, will alienate Pakistani citizens. Instead, you can have law enforcement. But let me say this, and I'm going to end here. Can you have political freedoms in Fatah without political freedoms in Pakistan? And that's a big issue. Because after all, if we're talking about, you know, representation, and we're talking about participation, and we're talking about civil and political rights, until this, you know, the state of Pakistan is once again a functioning democratic state, is Fatah likely to become a territory where there is functioning democracy? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ahmed, for your your points on FATA, and I'd like to really open up the floor to questions, because we rarely have a chance to speak to her and engage in a real conversation. So if you do have a question, come to a microphone. There's one on each side, on the left and right side, and identify yourself. And as folks are coming up, I would like Dr. Ahmed to think about one or two things that crossed my mind, and maybe we can discuss it, or maybe it'll be channeled into other conversations. I think that there's this, very cliche term, I think, that needs to be flushed out, and I think that would just help us out with many of us in D.C. and in the field, the Talibanization of Pakistan, or Talibanization culture. It's been used not only by civil society, academics in the West studying Pakistan, academics, of course, in South Asia, but also by the state. You hear General Musharraf using it all the time as a way to counteract the movement and counteracting the extremist rhetoric. And so the state's version of Talibanization is, I think, what we need to discuss, and also what's really on the ground, and what's your observations. So I think, and there's some cultural things there that I think many of us would benefit from your observations. Is it just recruitment and sending young boys out to fight? Is it some real ideology? Is where are the lines to tie to the JUI or tie to Omar, Mullah Omar? What does it really mean culturally, religiously, theologically, politically? And of course, socially, we know that there's this recruitment, a very sophisticated recruitment. And the other thing that's related to it is what you said very quickly is, and I think we need to talk about, is the propaganda mechanisms that is tied to any resurgence group or insurgency. We know the very sophisticated use of webs and posters and pamphlets and of course, the Friday and sermons and different institutions. But how is that? Because in this propaganda is sort of this global propaganda, and they're sort of counteracting the state propaganda and the MMA propaganda or the secularist propaganda or some other propaganda. So what we really like to learn, what do you think about those tactics? And lastly, about FATA, you made a very poignant point. Can we really discuss FATA without speaking about the rest of Pakistan? Civil society, civil rights, and of course, civil government. So is it fruitful to talk about FATA, its issues, its lack of representation in provincial government, without speaking about the process towards moving towards a civil, especially given what's been happening in the last 3 weeks with the Supreme Court justice being dismissed, and then these barrage of issues with lawyers and journalists and so forth. I really would like you somehow to tie some of those most recent events to what's happening in civil society in Pakistan. And of course, after those comments, please come to the microphones for your questions.
Thank you very much. Is this thing on?
Yes, it should
okay.
be.
Talibanization, what does it mean? It's shorthand for an ultra-Orthodox Deobandi ideology superimposed on Pashtunwali. Okay, that's what it is. Shorthand, and we can use the whole term. Or we could use Deobandi as well, right? Like, it's a radio man. But a type of Deobandi Islam, because we can't even call it Deobandiism mm-hmm. on its own, right? It's a extremely orthodox form of Deobandiism, along with certain attributes of Pashtunwali, but not all attributes of Pashtunwali either, right? And that is what we saw in the party, JUIF, okay? One of the things that's important to know about the JUIF is not just because that it's a Deobandi party, but it's also a Pashtun party. And that is why the JUIF madrasas are the madrasas where you had the Talibs of Afghan Pashtuns and Pakistani Pashtuns. And even now, most Deobandi madrasas have both. The JUIF connection is a connection that dates back, a long ways back, with the links between the JUI in Pakistan with the Pashtun Islamist elements in Afghanistan, right? In some ways, I guess it is one of the reasons why these people who are the Pakistani militants call themselves the Taliban is they in some ways don't recognize that they're separate people from the Afghans, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same Pashtun tribes, both sides of the border. They believe in pretty much exactly the same thing that the Afghan Talibs stand for. The Taliban structures that we're talking about, you know, now that becomes a separate issue. The structures that they're setting up resemble the kind of state that Mullah Omar was trying to set up, right? From the kind of Sharia punishments, the most recent, by the way, is the stoning to death of a couple. This was last month. They actually first stoned them and then they shot them. You used to see that happen in Afghanistan. Nobody could have thought we would see this happen in Pakistan. This is again in Bajor agency. You see other instances in which, you know, the same thing, chopping off the hands, dismemberment of the bodies. It's done with a purpose. It's not just because, they're sensationalists. It's an instrument of terror, and it's a very effective one, of imposing their version of ideology on people through the use of force. Right now, as we speak, even in the settled areas of the Northwest Frontier Province, where there was absolute tolerance, right? You have doctors being attacked for vaccinating children. There is the one mullah who has issued a fatwa that vaccinations are un-Islamic because it's God's will if a child dies or is crippled. This is not something that existed in these regions. By the way, this is in the Swat region. This used to be the territory of two liberal parties once upon a time before the events that have overtaken this region, which is the Awami National Party and the Pakistan People's Party. So you can well imagine what 7.5 years of military rule have done, which takes me to your third question. The marginalization and the systematic onslaught on the moderate parties and the assistance given to the Islamist parties by the Musharraf government. The alliance relationship, it's a wonderful alliance relationship because it works in multiple ways. To an American audience, General Musharraf can say, you know what, the threat is the mullahs. If it's not me, après moi, le deluge. He tells Pakistanis that I'm the one who is going to hold back the tide of militancy as well. His concept of enlightened moderation. But it doesn't take very much other than a look at the website of the government of Pakistan to find out that his party is in an alliance with the JUIF and the rest of the MMA in Balochistan. This is not exactly a state secret. So it works for the mullahs. They have received the patronage of the state for 7.5 years. They will still, if these elections are rigged, the national elections, and which is why we really believe how important these elections are going to be in more ways than one, not just for Pakistan, but also for Afghanistan. If these elections are free and fair, the moderate parties will win. We cannot predict which moderate party and which combination of alliance coalitions will be formed, but it will be the moderate parties that will win a free and fair election. Even in Balochistan, the two provinces, the two states controlled by the MMA, it will be the Baloch regional parties that will come up, because of the excesses of military rule. They've gained the support of the Baloch in a way they didn't have before. That will come back into power in alliance with one or the other of the national level parties, moderate parties. Northwest Frontier Province, the JUIF will still retain a considerable amount of its support, but there will be inroads made. Hazara, that area, was not JUIF territory. There's a huge number of seats in that area that belong to the Nawaz Sharif Muslim League. Up further, the Swat region, there was, now it's going to be hard for the PPP to win ground, but there were sympathies for the PPP in those areas. But that still means the mullah's space shrinks. But will Musharraf allow a free and fair election? And if he wants a rigged election, if he wants to rig the election to consolidate his power, who is it he can rely on? Okay, the marginal parties, the moderate parties are unacceptable. They're a threat. The only partner left then is the Islamist parties. What does he give them in return? And I think this is very important. When we talk about unconditional appeasement, well, unconditional appeasement's happened in more ways than one, which is the space created for the mullahs is not a space that's been created by the operations in Afghanistan. It's been the space created within Pakistan by the Pakistani military.
Thank you.
Good morning. Hi, Mary Louise Kelly with NPR. You mentioned the recent fighting, it looks like last week, in South Waziristan, and you mentioned how difficult it is from the outside to know exactly what's going on, but I wonder if you could give us a little bit more of your sense. The government in Islamabad, as you know, is portraying this as a hopeful development, as local fighters rising up against foreign fighters and enforcing the peace deal at some level. Do you think that is, in fact, what's happening?
You know, you have to think of history when you read these things and you don't have knowledge of what's happening on the ground. In the 1980s, during the days of the glorious Afghan jihad, the Mujahideen spent most of the time killing each other. Okay, it used to be internal fighting, turf wars. Here, from what one knows, the press reports that have come out, frankly speaking, that's all I can go by. It seems that there are two Taliban groups, one that has the Uzbeks as allies and the other that's opposing it, right? I mean, these are, when I say Taliban, I should again be careful, Pakistani militants who call themselves Taliban. And they are fighting with each other, right? And the government is now using this, and I think this is it's an important point you've raised, to justify the peace deals that have been made and to also propose a new peace deal, which is going to be in Bajor Agency. I should say that this morning I was reading the paper just before I came out, and there was an interesting news item of a development that took place yesterday in Bajor Agency, right? In which they say the local authorities have reached an agreement with local tribesmen in which they will not allow foreign and Pakistani militants to operate across the borders. So the first, you know, signal sent that they will go down in a policy of appeasement in Bajor as well. Of course, you know, saying that IMU is being attacked, the foreigners are being eliminated, the tribesmen are living up to their bargain, the Northwest Frontier Province governor said this 3 days ago. You hear a little bit of that now being echoed in Washington with Secretary Rice saying, well, now it seems that the militants are targeting the foreigners. But to me, I think it's very disturbing to see that these people were using heavy weapons against each other in Pakistani territory. They had rockets, they had mortars, they had sophisticated equipment. You're not talking about the leftovers of the Afghan war. These people are that heavily armed, they can conduct these kinds of private wars. The constitution of Pakistan does not permit private armies. Why is the state using them?
If I could just quickly follow up, again, on the situation in South Waziristan, the government is denying it's involved in any way. Locals who have been reached by phone say that they think Pakistani army is involved at some level. To what extent, I mean, is your guess that the government is coordinating or is in control at all of what's going on?
It's next to impossible to comment on that because there is no information that's coming out except that the version the government is giving out, right? I mean, unless that we do get some credible, and I must say this is where the Pakistani press has played such an incredibly important role. They've been so brave to cover these events because, you know, the way journalists have been threatened. And yet they've been in there and they've covered them. Right now, if the state doesn't allow the media access, doesn't allow independent human rights organizations access, doesn't allow the ICRC access, we don't know.
Thank you. I'm Bob Hathaway with the Wilson Center. Nice to welcome you back to Washington. I've got about 24 questions here that your comments provoked. I will not ask all 24. What I'd like to do is really focus on the subtitle of your recent report, Appeasing the Militants. I suspect that you all thought long and hard about that subtitle. As of course you know, appeasement in the Western discourse is a nasty term, stemming back from the Second World War, suggests that if you appease someone, you simply encourage further demands and further aggression. Now, fast forward to today. There's increasing talk, certainly in Pakistan, certainly in Afghanistan, at a lower level here in Washington about dealing with the moderate Taliban. I'm frankly confused whether or not there's such a thing as a moderate Taliban. So I would really, in the context of your subtitle about appeasement, what do you think are the prospects and the likelihood of success of distinguishing between certain groups of Taliban and negotiating political deals of any significance with people who we've lumped together as Taliban?
Well, that's an important question, and it's one that is of great concern to us in the Afghanistan context in particular, because that is where the talk is coming from. In Kabul, you hear it everywhere on how well, you know, we have to understand they're Afghan citizens, and after all, some of them have been misled, and so we need to bring them into the fold, and then later on. Now, what we've, talking to Afghan authorities, we've raised this issue and said, is there going to be a vetting process? Is there going to be a cutoff date? Are you then telling people that, well, you know what, if you pick up the gun and you kill people, you will be rewarded? Because that's not exactly what you want to say in a country that is in post-conflict and that has been gone through 25-some years of civil war. In the Pakistani context, it's the same thing. When we say appeasement, we use the term very deliberately because it was unconditional and it has encouraged bad behavior. This has not been peacemaking, the Pakistani state reaching out to its citizens, because after all, its citizens have been killed and are still being killed there. What we have said in our report, and we've said it, we said apprehend those people who are killing Pakistani citizens or Pakistani soldiers. We are making no distinctions here and saying that, you know, the military deserves casualties. We are saying no, these people are criminals and they should be held accountable. How can you? You know, when you look, I mean, the question that I didn't actually even answer about propaganda, right? The movies, the CDs, the DVDs that are circulating, mm-hmm. they're out there. They don't mask themselves. Mm-hmm. They boast about what they've done, right? And these are distributed. So it's not a matter of ignorance that you don't know who the folks are, because after all, those are the folks who signed the agreement. But it's the failure to take action, and when the military takes action, I mean, what we are saying is law enforcement comes first, really, here. Extend political and civil rights, remove that fiction that Fatah is a part of, is not a part of the Pakistani state, but is something else. Remove the fiction that these people are not citizens of your country and they deserve the same protections. And then, along with that, you know, once you've got to integrate the region into the Pakistani state, extend the writ of the court, because how else will you even have law enforcement? Can we, at this point in time, when these guys are running the show, say that some of them are moderate and we can bring them into the fold? I think it would be next to impossible to make a distinction on who is moderate and who is an extremist. It's the locals who are on the receiving end of what is happening in Fatah that are the most apprehensive of what will happen if more concessions are made to the militants.
Actually, can I make a comment about those videos? Some of us, I see folks who are in this meeting, we had to sit through some Al-Qaeda recruitment
videos. You look videos. The other way.
I look the other way. I didn't have a stomach for it. But yes, Marvin was there, so was David. We had the opportunity to view some of these Al-Qaeda recruitment DVDs that included, among other things, human slaughter. And the thing that was quite interesting about these DVDs is exactly what Samina said. The locals were you could see their faces. There was absolutely no effort whatsoever to hide the face of the locals. Ostensibly, according to Hussein, who was sort of just Hussein Akhani, who was describing what we were seeing, it tended to be the foreign fighters who had their face masked. But the locals were completely available and filmed full face, no problem identifying them if you wanted to do that.
They were horrendous.
Yes.
Honestly, even strong stomach people, you have trouble with this. They spared no one. And as you say, it's just the purpose of saying it's a threat, you know, as much as that's the recruitment part of the threat. You know, with us, this is what you can be labeled a spy.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Joel Wishengrad of World Media Reports, WMR News. I cover State Department. One of the two questions I wanted to ask you, what has been the fallout from the recent trip by President Bush? He did meet with President Musharraf to Afghanistan, and also in Pakistan, rather. And also, what is the overall effect of what Secretary Rice is trying to pursue now, and also Under Secretary of State Richard Boucher? Thank you.
Thank you. You know, there was a huge amount of media coverage of Vice President Cheney's trip, because it was assumed then that a serious talking to was given to Musharraf. But here's the thing. First, when the Vice President came back, there were attributed remarks to a senior official, and then, you know, everybody picked it up and said, well, you know, I mean, it's this time, you know, Musharraf's in for it. But the Vice President came back and he said, well, I didn't do all that. That's one. Second, right after, you know, the Vice President said, well, you know, he's a good friend and an ally, the State Department made the same remarks. You know, you had the senior at most levels of the State Department saying that Musharraf's a great ally, that he's doing a wonderful job, you know, well, we wouldn't be able to fight the war on terror without him, which is all very well, that's still rhetoric. But in actuality, the only signal that possibly could have been sent is there a debate now that if we are giving unconditional rewards to Musharraf, there are going to be some conditionalities attached? I don't see that debate. So how much of an impact will it have on Pakistani policy, on General Musharraf or his government? You know, it's the same thing. Unless if the intent is followed by some action, it's not going to have any impact at all. Because what we see is Secretary Rice, you've had just about everybody now saying that they have deep concerns about the peace deals with the Taliban, with the militants in Pakistan, and that the U.S. does not think this is delivering. And in fact, the U.S. thinks this is leading to greater threats to U.S. national security, to Afghanistan and to Pakistan itself. And yet, the Musharraf government is saying, we think we're going to do a peace deal in Bajor now. So the signaling, I think, out of Washington has been very mixed. That, I think, is a part of the problem. And that, I think, also answers this question about Assistant Secretary Boucher. Because after all, he's a spokesperson of the administration. And if you read his testimony, actually, that's really important. Read the testimonies of the Armed Services Committee, of the guys in uniform. And then read Ambassador Boucher's testimony. And you can't believe it's coming from the same administration.
Point of information, the House of Representatives has passed legislation conditioning USA. The Senate did not pass that, and the administration strongly opposed.
Yes, and it has to be reconciled now, and we have to wait and see absolutely.
Thanks. I'm Josh White at Johns Hopkins Heiss. And my question has to do with both the short-term and the long-term effects of a regularization of the Fatah areas. I think we would all agree that over the long term, bringing those areas into the political system of Pakistan could have some real benefits. I want to ask about some of the short-term implications of that kind of change on a few fronts. I think we could easily see, for example, the JUI significantly increasing its representation in the provincial assembly, were many of these agencies to be converted into districts as such. And in the north, Jamaat-e-Islami and some of the northern agencies. And then the question of how you transition from the current system of governance to one that is under the authority of the province. I think Malakand is an interesting case in this regard, as it's tried to transition from an agency into something that more resembles a district, but still has, several years later, tremendous issues with the politicization of the police in that area, and trying to bring about a new kind of structure that is accountable in a political sense to the local leaders under the devolution reforms, but also has enough independence that the central government can can exert its writ in those areas. So if you could talk about this problem of transition and how to overcome potentially some of those obstacles in what would really be a very dramatic change of the political landscape.
First of all, it's not all that dramatic. Okay, extending the writ of the courts of Pakistan is not dramatic. Making sure that citizens over there have civil and political rights is not dramatic. Allowing political parties to operate in Fatah is not dramatic. None of that is dramatic. In fact, FCR was applied to Balochistan until the Supreme Court said, you know what, remove it. And you know what, it wasn't dramatic. So we tend to overemphasize the fact that this area is different. In actual fact, when you're traveling through Fatah, you know what, as you know, I mean, I know a few travel through Fatah, right? But Fatah itself is divided into areas that are under the jurisdiction of the federal government as well. So you're actually, what they call Ilaka Ghair is Fatah, right? So you're traveling on the main road, you're in federal government territory, you step off the road, you're in Ilaka Ghair, right? What happens in Ilaka Ghair? In places like Dehradun Khel, for example, gun running, drug smuggling, these are the end products of no rule of law. Okay, the end products of no rule of law. They're saying deprive the people who live in Fatah, because we are uncomfortable with that idea of transition, for another 10 years of any civil or political rights, or 15 years of any civil or political rights, or any protection of the court. Then we have a problem with our own analysis of Fatah. Okay? If you're saying that the JUIF and the Islamist parties will increase their number of seats in the national parliament if Fatah becomes a part of the North West Frontier province, open the area to the political parties first, allow political freedoms, and then let's see how much support the militants have. We can't judge. You know, there's something that we have constantly asked is how much support does Musharraf have, and we say we can't judge for a simple reason. There's only one way to gauge it, through the ballot box. We are making predictions right now. And even if, let's assume that every voter in Fatah votes for the JUIF, okay, and the number of seats increases by 10 more. Right now, fact is, there is no independent Fatah parliamentarian in the National Assembly. They already, all of them, because there's a denial of access to the moderate parties, belong to the JUIF or the Jamaat-e-Islami. So what are we saying here? 10 seats are going to make such a difference that for 10 years we deprive these people of any rights and any protections. And also, the state doesn't have the tools to enforce its writ. Don't forget, there are two sides of this. This is absolutely essential. The longer the state treats this territory differently, and we are in the 21st century, that we have rules like FCR, and we think this is acceptable because it might be a shock to the system. We have to be very careful when we talk about these nuances.
Hi, Lisa Curtis with the Heritage Foundation. It's so nice to see you, Samina. Thank you. My question gets back to the earlier question about how you make the U.S.-Pakistan dialogue more productive and how you clarify the signals coming from Washington. And I would look at the recent Waziristan fighting as a case in point. Okay, you know, the IMU, the Uzbek militants, you know, a lot of fighting there. My question would be, where's the Taliban in all this? You know, we're seeing reports that Jalaluddin Haqqani is trying to reconcile the two groups. How can this be helpful? Clearly, the Taliban are still a major problem. What we hear from the Pakistan government often is, well, we can't tell the difference between the Afghan refugees and the Taliban. This seems to be skirting the real issue. And the fact that, you know, we need to be talking about getting at the infrastructure of the Taliban, the leadership, the training camps, getting at the root of the problem. So how can we keep the dialogue focused on the case in point? It seems like we constantly are getting off point and getting distracted from the real issue, and that's why 5 years down the line we have the Taliban resurging in Afghanistan. So I guess my question would be, and I know it's not an easy one, but how can we keep the dialogue on point?
I think it's a very important one, especially right now, given the fact that I would say that 2007 in some ways is make or break here for Afghanistan as well. If the insurgency in the south isn't contained, and if it spreads to the east, you know, there's already so much concern in the center west and in the north about the Taliban resurgence, because people are saying, you know what? I mean, these guys are going to win this war, and we have to arm ourselves. So we are almost going back into the same mode when people start thinking in terms of which group is going to capture Kabul. And we really can't afford to have that happen. The other side of the border, you're absolutely right, command and control is a crucial issue. Now, you know very well that in all the testimonies given to Congress, from the highest levels of U.S. government, it has been, there are areas that have been identified as command and control centers of the Taliban and of Hikmat-e-Arsis-based Lami. And they include the Waziristans. If that focus is there on, command and control is crucial because two reasons. Well, one of the things that we see in Afghanistan is a far more sophisticated level of operation in terms of the insurgency. It's far more, organized. It isn't the kind of random violence we saw in the first years of the insurgency. So the other effect, of course, is command and control is demoralization, right? You still have the middle-level commanders, you still have the low-level commanders operating because there's a lot of autonomy as well within Afghanistan, right? And across the border in Pakistan. Sources of recruitment. I think that's going to be a very important issue as well. Because one of the things that, officials tell us in Kabul is constantly, they constantly say this to us, how are we supposed to stabilize Afghanistan if we can't drain the swamp? If you're going to have hundreds of young kids coming across from Pakistan. In fact, it is not what one wants to see. Because as I said, it affects both Pakistan and Afghanistan. When these kids are killed in Afghanistan and their bodies come back, and their funeral, in Balochistan, for example, where Musharraf is has an alliance government with the JUI, you have the JUI parliamentarians going to the funerals and talking about the Shaheeds. So sources of recruitment. I think that's another thing that needs to be focused on a little bit more than U.S. government is right now focusing on. Terror financing is a very difficult issue. But somebody is arming this war because, no insurgency is fought on the cheap. And don't tell me it's drug money because everybody is, has a bit of the drug money. And in Afghanistan, most of the proceeds of the drug money are, the big fish are even outside the region. But you've got to feed them, you've got to clothe them, you've got to get the weapons, you've got to get the operational logistics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Something about where's the money coming from. But beyond that is where's the support coming from? I mean, we have a problem here that the U.S. still assumes that Musharraf is our man and the military is the only institution in Pakistan worth functioning. In other words, it's tied itself to a handful of people, ignoring the fact that it has totally alienated its national allies in Pakistan. Okay? The moderate parties are out there in the cold. Nobody wants to even talk to them. You talk about U.S. strategies towards Pakistan. Isn't it about time that, the U.S. started looking at civilian alternatives? And I know in your own book you've suggested this, and it's really, really important. Where do we want Pakistan to go? If the people of Pakistan are given the right to choose their own government, these people are moderate, and they will make the right choices. What I hear in D.C. every time I come is, there's no civilian alternative, the corrupt politicians, those useless political parties. In other words, no trust in the Pakistani people. The U.S. has not reached out to Pakistani civil society. The U.S. has not reached out to Pakistan, the representatives of the Pakistani people. The U.S. has limited its connections, its links to the Pakistani military. So the U.S. doesn't understand how to get from A to B, which is how to get from where it is right now with a military ally who's not delivering, right, to a civilian alternative that will work, because there's no trust. And I think that this is the point in time that the U.S. must seriously start reaching out to civilian politicians. 7 years of demonizing the political parties and the political leaders. They have huge faults, no doubt about it. But the important thing here is the process. We talked about this earlier on in the Afghanistan context, right? When the Afghan parliamentary elections are going to be held, everybody said, oh my gosh, all those warlords and drug dealers and the rest of it. And we said, you know what? It's a process. Let the Afghan people elect their representatives. If the process continues, you will have the rules of the game, which will be far more stable. In the Pakistani case, it's the same thing. The process, 7.5 years, has been interrupted. If it doesn't restart now, think of a rigged election, another 5 years of military rule. What happens then to the moderate majority?
Thank you.
Rebecca Cataldi from the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy. You mentioned just briefly before the role of the Pakistani madrasas, and I just wondered if you could elaborate on that a little bit more. How do you see their role in relation to the Talibanization of Pakistan, in relation to the cross-border violence and the general spread of ideology? Thanks.
Before I answer your question, I should say this, that Pakistan has not been Talibanized. It's not a country where people are Talibans. This is one particular area that we're talking about, very limited, very restricted territory, in which we see this phenomena, but we see the dangers of it spreading. Go anywhere else in Pakistan, you're not going to find Talibans. You're going to find people who are completely moderate, have the same liberal values as any other people. The madrasas are a problem. Okay, again, we've done reports on the madrasas, and oh my gosh, were we slammed on those reports. You don't know what you're talking about, because after all, the madrasas are wonderful institutions of learning. They're community-based centers. They are the only source of education for millions of poor, deprived Pakistani children. Our concern was not the madrasa as an institution. Our concern was the madrasa when it's distorted, okay? When the madrasa teaches extremism, when the madrasa exploits the children of the poor, when the state does not regulate the madrasa but allows the madrasa to become an institution of jihad instead of an institution of learning. We're taking out another report on the madrasas. We're stubborn folks. So this comes out today saying the same things, that you've got to understand the madrasas are a problem. Even the moderate madrasas, because the religious part of the curriculum does need to be modified. There needs to be state control over the living standards of the children there, needs to be state control over the sources of funding. The state at least needs to know who's funding the madrasas. But the jihadi madrasas are the biggest problem, right? They're a small percentage of the whole, 10 to 15 at the most. These are the ones that produce these young kids. The JUIF madrasas, I would put in some ways, not all JUIF madrasas perhaps, but a huge number of the JUIF madrasas are jihadi madrasas. They've been jihadi madrasas since the 1980s, when they produced recruits for the jihad in Afghanistan. The Jamaat-e-Islami's madrasas, which is a very small network of madrasas, produced jihadis for Kashmir. The madrasa sector has come more in the limelight now because of Great Britain as well, and the terror threats there, because now, you know, the British have started tracing wannabe terrorists going to Pakistani madrasas and tying up with jihadi groups there. Jihadi groups and the madrasa nexus is the clear one, but the jihadi madrasa and the Afghan Taliban connection is also a clear one. It's nothing new. It's been there a long time. It's very difficult to say, ask the Pakistani state how many foreign students are there in Pakistani madrasas, and they say none. And then you say, how many Afghans? But they say, that's different. Because you can't make a distinction between the Afghans and the Pakistanis. And it is difficult amongst the Pakistani and the Afghan Pashtuns. Of course, if you ask them, are you a Pakistani or an Afghan, you'll get a clear answer. No Afghan will call himself a Pakistani. No Pakistani will call himself an Afghan, except in the tribal belt where they use both terms simultaneously. But the madrasas are booming. There was a time after September 11th, the first year, when there was this Musharraf government did actually put a certain amount of pressure, or at least intended to, that the madrasa managers were much more careful. Now they're full. There's no way that this phenomena can be dealt with unless the state has the intent to regulate the madrasa sector. And at this point in time, General Musharraf has not demonstrated any intent.
Okay. Yeah. Dr. Samina. My name is Munawar. I'm Lagari with World Sindhi Institute. You use two terms like Pakistani Talib and local militants. I want to know that what do you think, how many Punjabis or Sindhis or Balochis or Pashtun in Pakistani Talib, when you mention the Pakistani Talib, and local militants? What do you mean from the local militants? These from mostly Punjab or from Pakistan or from Balochistan or from Sindh? And what is the role of ISI, major role of the ISI to helping and supporting to these Taliban, and especially in Waziristan. I want to know from.
If you're talking about ethnicity, and I think this is what you're referring to, that the largest number of a particular ethnic group have joined this particular cause. You know, when we're talking, this report was on Fatah. Fatah is in the Northwest Frontier Province. As far as I know, there aren't any Balochi Sindhis in the Northwest Frontier Province, or very few Punjabis. They are Pashtuns. But if we are to say jihadis in Pakistan are only limited to the Pashtuns, I think it would be very unfair to the Pashtun people. We would be saying every Pashtun is an Islamic radical. That is certainly not true. Some of the most progressive, most liberal parties in Pakistan are Pashtun parties. And in fact, these are parties that have preceded the independence of Pakistan, and they still are parties that have popular support and legitimacy. So let's not start branding people as one or the other, that these are certain people are more prone towards Islamic extremism than others. It's a phenomena that is linked very much in this area, is linked to the years of the Afghan jihad. Because geographically this area was contiguous to Afghanistan. This is where the madrasas and the bases were set up. The Afghan jihad was fought out of this region. Suppose the Afghan jihad, suppose Sindh had been next to Afghanistan, of the Punjab or Balochistan. The Pashtun belt of Balochistan, yes, it happened. The Pashtun belt of Balochistan is where the jihadi madrasas were set up for the jihad in Afghanistan. The Baloch parts of Balochistan were not affected by the jihad and by jihadi philosophy. And till this day, the Baloch are not affected by it. That's absolutely correct. The Baloch regional parties are liberal parties. But fact still remains that I think we would be very unfair on the Pashtuns if we start lumping them. Every Pashtun is a Talib and every Pashtun is a jihadi.
Yes.
Hi. Laura Heaton from United Press International. I was wondering, what we're hearing right now in the U.S., the administration is justifying its cozy relationship with Musharraf by telling us, you know, we're just one bullet away from dot, dot, dot. And so I wonder, from your perspective, what would happen if Musharraf were gone suddenly? And is this a serious concern? Should we believe this sort of rhetoric coming from Secretary Rice, from President Bush, to justify their position? Thank you.
I think when the administration so closely identifies itself with an individual, it does the United States a disservice. It does not help very much for an administration to believe that a country of 160 million people depends, the fate of a country of 160 million people depends on one individual. And it is not even very good policy. Beyond that, let me say this, that if tomorrow General Musharraf is removed for any reason, would it make a difference? It would depend on what follows. If there is a democratic transition, if there are free and fair elections, then I think we will see a stable, democratic, moderate Pakistan. If we see the military retaining power, then I think we have more problems on the road. But then the military is what the U.S. government believes is the only answer to every regional problem.
Well, we need to stop at this moment because Dr. Ahmed needs to attend another engagement. So thank you very much for joining us here at USIP, and hope to see you again, Dr. Ahmed.